Hello, it is Wednesday, the first day of July. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. South Korean exports in June notched $102.25 billion, marking the first time that the monthly exports surpassed the $100 billion mark. More on that in our daily news briefing shortly. In our in-depth news analysis segment, we'll talk about the financial crisis at the United Nations with two experts. Plus, we'll review the heart of the Naga during our weekly Korea Book Club, a book that could be adapted into a computer game. All that and more on Korea 24. South Korea's exports in June topped $100 billion U.S. dollars for the first time, buoyed by a surge in semiconductor shipments amid the ongoing artificial intelligence boom. The country also posted a monthly trade balance exceeding $30 billion, the largest on record. To give the latest on the trade figures, as well as some of the other headlines of the day, we have our KBS World News editor, Koo Hee-jin, joining us on the line. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Andrew.
Now, these are as yet preliminary figures released by the Ministry of Trade, Industry and Resources. Can you break down the ministry's monthly trade report?
Yes, of course. The Trade Ministry disclosed that South Korea's exports surged 70.9% year on year to an all-time high of $102.25 billion in June. The figure tops the previous record of $87.75 billion set just a month prior. South Korea is the fourth country in the world after Germany, China, and the United States to surpass $100 billion in monthly exports, fueled by a strong global demand for semiconductors.
So we know chips played a big role there, but how much of the total was from semiconductor exports?
Well, chip shipments alone amounted to $44.82 billion, accounting for about 44% of all exports, boosted by a surge in memory prices fueled by the AI boom. Exports of computers rose more than 308% to $5.41 billion, while outbound shipments of wireless communication devices, including smartphones, increased by nearly 52% to over $1.5 billion. Exports of petroleum products and petrochemicals also showed stellar double-digit growth, driven by higher international oil prices. Reflecting the June trade performance, the country posted a record high trade surplus of $36.15 billion, bringing the cumulative surplus for the first 6 months to $138.3 billion.
And given the ongoing market trends, South Korea seems on track to reach $1 trillion export milestone this year. Let's look at some of the other headlines. The ruling Democratic Party majority in the National Assembly has elected chairs for 10 parliamentary standing committees and one special budget committees in the second half of the 22nd National Assembly amid a boycott by the main opposition. Hee-jin, what can you tell us about those tapped to be committee chairs?
Well, at a plenary session Tuesday, Democratic Party Representative Seo-yong-kyo was elected to lead the Legislation and Judiciary Committee. Representative Yu Dong-soo, the National Policy Committee, and Representative Cho Seung-nae, the Finance, Economy, Planning and Budget Committee. Representative Song Ki-yeon will chair the Science, ICT, Broadcasting and Communications Committee. Representative Jin Song-jun, the National Defense Committee. And Representative Kim Yong-jin, the Public Administration and Security Committee. The ruling party announced the candidate recommendations for 11 of 18 committee chief posts on Tuesday after failing to narrow differences with the main opposition People Power Party over the chair of the Legislation and Judiciary Committee. The PPP boycotted the plenary vote in protest and submitted a resignation letter to the Assembly Secretariat after Speaker Cho Jong-sik unilaterally appointed PPP lawmakers to the 11 committees.
And the nation's newly appointed Prime Minister, Han Sung-suk, began her first day in office. She told reporters that in this era of upheaval, South Korea is shedding its status as a follower and becoming a leader of change. What else did she say?
Well, Han, the nation's 50th Prime Minister and the second woman to fill the post, vowed on Wednesday to do her best so that the Lee Jae-myung administration can swiftly and implement necessary policies in a timely manner, including those that favor bold investment in artificial intelligence and high-tech industries. She also stressed that she will actively review regulations so they don't unnecessarily stifle innovation, but instead ensure the progress benefits everyone and creates opportunities and growth for young people. Han, the former chief executive of the internet giant Naver, had been serving as cabinet minister for small and mid-sized enterprises under President Lee. She indicated that in her role, she will help the public and private sectors work together to drive economic success and will focus on promoting measures that benefit the public.
In other news, lawmakers from both sides of the aisle slammed the National Election Commission for responding passively to the parliamentary investigation into ballot paper shortages that occurred during the June 3rd local elections. Heejin, can you provide more details about these concerns being raised?
Well, lawmakers spoke out during a second briefing by the election watchdog on the ballot shortages at a plenary session of the special parliamentary committee in charge of the inquiry into them. The lawmakers also alleged that the NEC had been informed in advance of the plans and findings of an independent fact-finding committee. However, the commission denied receiving any improper advance notice. The NEC apologized again for the disruption and announced reform measures, including printing enough ballots for 100% of registered voters, having three full-time election commissioners, and establishing an independent audit committee through legislation. Meanwhile, acting NEC chair Wee Chul-hwan said that he rejected calls to resign from the main opposition People Power Party, saying such a step would be irresponsible in the current situation and could create greater difficulties.
President Lee Jae-myung and former President Moon Jae-in held a luncheon at Cheongwadae on Wednesday discussing internal unity within the ruling liberal camp as the bloc seeks to expand its political boundaries. Heejin, can you tell us more about their meeting?
Well, Lee said the liberal government of the Democratic Party has become a major force that should take responsibility for the nation and that it must fundamentally represent every member of the public while conducting politics and fulfilling administrative duties for everyone. The president said his popular sovereignty-oriented government is building on the achievements of the liberal governments of Kim Dae-jung, Nomu-hyun, and Moon Jae-in, and is focusing on restoring Moon's accomplishments, which were damaged by ousted President Yoon Suk-yeol. Moon, for his part, expressed hope that he would achieve the dream of becoming everyone's president and stressed that the administration's task at the time is uniting the nation. The former president said internal unity within the ruling party would serve as the starting point, adding that he is currently the only person in the country who can realize the envisioned process. Regarding inter-Korean ties, Moon, who met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in 2018 at the historic Panmunjom summit, said he anticipates the resumption of dialogue so long as Seoul perseveres in its attempts at engagement.
And that's it for today's news briefing. Thank you, Heejin, for these updates.
Thank you.
The United Nations is going through a deep financial crisis. The organization's unpaid assessments rose to $2.8 billion as of April, while unpaid peacekeeping assessments stood at $3.5 billion. With major budget shortfalls and U.S. funding pullbacks, the U.N. has seen over 3,000 U.N. and global agency jobs cut or relocated since 2025. Secretary General Antonio Guterres has repeatedly spoken about the organization's worsening liquidity crisis, but his starkest warning came as early as this year, saying that the UN needs to overhaul its financial rules or, quote, accept the very real prospect of financial collapse. Since 1945, the UN has sought to promote peace and multilateral diplomacy. Its potentially slow collapse would represent a threat to critical UN missions around the world. To understand this financial crisis and what the future holds for the UN, we'll talk with two experts today who will provide us with different insights about the situation. First, we talk to Daniel Forti, the head of UN affairs at the International Crisis Group, to get the facts on the details of the financial crisis. Then later, we'll talk to another expert at the New York University's Center on International Cooperation to discuss potential long-term reforms and what role South Korea could play in addressing such problems. Mr. Forti, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Andrew.
So first, can you give us a brief 101 on this budget crisis at the UN? How bad is the crisis?
This is one of the worst financial crises the United Nations has faced in its 80 years. There are multiple factors that are at play right now, but essentially you have a situation where the organization's largest donors are not paying considerable amounts of obligatory funding that they owe the organization, while at the same time pressuring this organization and all of its aspects across peace and security, human rights, and development to constrain their footprints and just have a much smaller presence around the world. So combined cash shortages with a much larger effort to reduce the organization's overall budget has led to a situation where diplomats in New York have to fundamentally reconsider what the UN can and realistically cannot do across world affairs.
So Mr. Forti, what is the main cause though of this crisis?
So the UN has had financial trouble for a number of years now. I don't want to give off the impression that this has come out of the blue. A lot of it has been driven by the policies of its two major largest funders, the United States and China. They have, prior to 2025, given less and less of what they owe and giving it on time, which has forced the UN to rely on many other countries who pay far less and consider. I think it's about 60% the rest of the world pays relative to the US and China paying about 40% across the main budget lines. And that's forced the organization to take more and more conservative approaches. This issue got dramatically worse in 2025 with the return of the Trump administration to the White House, at which point they put a pause on all of their UN funding and very much have forced the organization into a considerable reevaluation of its priorities and financial spending, known now as the UN 80 process, which is a reform initiative that took place during the organization's 80th year. And this has been combined with the effort to reduce the organization's footprint. So you have many different parts of the UN having to cut thousands of jobs, prioritize which countries the UN can or cannot actually deliver aid in, shrink UN peacekeeping missions, while at the same time, the US has not paid nearly 60 to 70% of the cash it owes, forcing the organization into what financial experts call a liquidity crisis, where it doesn't have cash on hand. There is one last dimension, just to say, just to very briefly allude to. The organization's financial rules are very complex, and one particular rule is causing a lot of headaches for the UN right now, which is where the organization, like many other public sector institutions, is forced to return any money that is not spent on its annual budget. What makes this issue particularly more difficult right now is that there's no exception that the organization can reduce the amount it owes when countries don't pay. Mm. So it's forced to return money that it hasn't actually collected from its members. And that has sort of got this UN into what the Secretary General has called a Kafkaesque spiral of liquidity crisis. And these as a sort of approximate cause right now for the really difficult financial troubles the organization's in.
Sounds almost like a company that's running into financial problems. Mr. Forti, you're approaching the UN from the International Crisis Group. Can you explain exactly what role the UN normally plays in crises around the world and what this budget issue could mean?
Absolutely. I would break this down into two main dimensions. One is on sort of your peace and security side, so where the organization does political dialogue, sends Blue Helmet peacekeepers to provide physical protection to help restore basic services in crisis-affected countries, and then the organization's humanitarian sector, where it really is on the front lines of countries from, you know, Venezuela, which is just recovering from a devastating earthquake, to situations like South Sudan, where perpetual cycles of violence and environmental degradation really make it harder for civilians to survive on a daily basis. And the UN does lots of things in those places. It has large 10,000-person UN peacekeeping missions, which are established deployments mandated by the Security Council. It uses its both sort of humanitarian sector through OCHA or aid agencies like the World Food Program and UNICEF to do everything from education campaigns to vaccination drives or to life-saving recovery, as you have when there are environmental disasters on the way. These budget issues essentially mean that the UN is forced to do less in those contexts and more to prioritize which are the cases and the context and the issues where it can deliver, and increasingly those where it can't. The head of humanitarian affairs, Tom Fletcher, has made it very clear that it's less about sort of the UN being able to save everyone, but just having to very much prioritize which cases it can deliver and understandably which ones it can't.
You were touching on this just now, but can you give us concrete examples of these missions being hit the hardest?
Absolutely. I'll give you two contexts where you have decade-old UN peacekeeping operations where we've seen very concerning and worrying impacts of the financial crisis. In the Democratic Republic of the Congo and South Sudan, those are missions where the UN has been forced to reduce the amount of patrols it can do. So, you know, you have fewer peacekeepers going out on routine cycles to provide presence and to deter armed groups from attacking civilians. The UN has been forced to reduce the amounts of flights it can take in certain contexts. So, you know, in many of these contexts, it is harder for the UN to get to areas where civilians need the most support on the ground and relies on air travel. And that becomes even a much harder ask in certain environments. UN staffers have been cut. So in some cases, the countries that have contributed troops to these missions have been asked to repatriate or send some home in order to save the overall mission cash. These are decisions that are prioritized based on the needs and the analysis of the conflict dynamics, but they're not done because the UN thinks that the conditions have improved to the point where there are fewer areas of support needed. It's done in order to make sure the UN actually has enough cash on hand and enough financial backing to keep its overall operations afloat. And then beyond this, just in many of the humanitarian contexts around the world, we've seen tens of thousands of job cuts across the board since the beginning of 2025. And that has just meant the organization has fewer hands and fewer individuals actually being able to deliver. It means that funding from the UN to local aid groups and local organizations that, you know, are often on the front lines of these efforts and sort of investing in the communities to become more self-sustaining in these responses have taken a big hit. So all in all, this is, you know, this has had a devastating impact on the UN's ability to deliver on the ground.
You mentioned how this didn't come out of the blue. The UN has for years been seen by some as a symbol of the failing post-war, post-Cold War liberal order. Do you think this financial crisis marks a turning point?
I would say that the financial crisis is a symptom of a larger geopolitical shift. And for many, multilateral cooperation is just less of a preferred vehicle for dealing with international political crises and security challenges. We at Crisis Group would understand that evolution, but still do believe that multilateral cooperation, whether through the UN or other regional bodies or arrangements, is still a very effective avenue for collective burden sharing and for dealing with challenges that know no borders, that are linked to political and security issues in different regions and around the world. And in a moment like now, where, you know, where you see the war in Sudan or Ukraine or even the tensions we saw around Iran, where so many of the issues are interlinked across regions, across the economic and political sphere, it's harder for any one state to decisively address those on its own. Mm. Now, the UN is an imperfect organization. We see in New York all the time that there are opportunities to reform, to improve the organization's bureaucracy. Obviously, the Security Council has lost a lot of its luster because it is seen as an ineffective and at times illegitimate body for making major decisions on international peace and security. But it still has an important role to play, whether on dealing with issues of international law, on peace and security, on norm and agenda setting. But this financial crisis makes it even harder to make those cases to the states and to, most importantly, the civilians affected by conflict, that the UN can be an effective partner. Addressing the financial crisis would be just one step in a larger effort to reform multilateral cooperation that is not just isolated.
So we're going to dive more into this in a little bit. But Mr. Forty, briefly, what is your take on how and what should be done in terms of reviving the United Nations financially?
I would say there need to be reforms and changes at different levels. So some of them, you know, you can get through negotiations at the United Nations, and others will need major states, including both the US and China, to show more political investment in the organization and multilateral cooperation. So even right now, diplomats in New York are finishing up negotiations on the annual peacekeeping budget. If, as part of that, they can agree to a reform to change this credit rule that I mentioned earlier, where basically the UN would no longer be expected to return money it hasn't collected, yet alone unspent, that would be an important step to alleviate some of this shock. Understandably, also, you know, having a clear priority among all 193 member states about how the UN can become more streamlined, reduce duplications in some of its organizations, agree on a common set of political and operational priorities. That will take a bit more time, but it's certainly necessary to give the institution a lot more of a steady ground on which it can actually operate within an environment of less resources. But at the larger level, we do need major states to show and understand that the UN can serve their interests and promote a more collective view of political and security goods. You know, in particular, the Trump administration and the Chinese administration would need to get the messages that, you know, instead of trying to starve the UN in order to extract reforms or their own views on the organization, they should see it in their interest as well to give the UN the funding it needs to actually become a more effective partner to not only their needs, but the interests of all member states.
sounds like a simple but also very difficult problem. Simple always doesn't mean easy. But that was the head of UN Affairs at the International Crisis Group, Mr. Forti. Thank you for your time today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Now, to learn more about what we can do, we have joining us on the line Thibault Kamelli, a former diplomat to the UN and research scholar on UN reform with the Center on International Cooperation at New York University. He has recently written a report titled How to End the United Nations Current Financial Crisis and Prevent Future Ones. Welcome to our show, Mr. Kamelli.
Thank you for having me, Andrew.
First, before we jump into the solution and preventions, what is your take on the entire situation right now at the United Nations, especially in the geopolitical and historical context?
Sure. Well, Danielle made a very compelling case for the causes and consequences of the financial crisis, and including on peacekeeping operations. And as I was listening to his presentation, I very much agree with one point that he made, that it's probably the symptom of a larger shift. And I wonder if we're actually addressing the right problem. And probably the financial crisis is actually not so much the heart of the problem, but just a symptom of a deeper root cause. And essentially, I would say three things are worth pointing out. The first one, financial crises within the UN are not new. Danielle was saying it's the worst financial crisis in its history. I think you can go back in time and look at the previous iterations where a similar judgment was made. And these crises go back to even the predecessor of the UN, up to the League of Nations. But if you think of it, when the first peacekeeping operations, the first armed peacekeeping operations was created, that was in the wake of the Suez Crisis. The Soviet Union and France refused to pay for the funding of that peacekeeping operations, and that came to be the first near bankruptcy of the UN in the 60s. And then it happened again in the 80s, again back at the end of the 90s, where essentially the General Assembly decided to reassess and redesign entirely how member states contribute to the budget. In the current instance, the General Assembly has been discussing the quote-unquote financial crisis, as we're seeing it today, for the past 7 years. So you might wonder if it's actually really a crisis anymore, if it's happened for the past 7 years. I would say what's different now, and that's the second point I wanted to raise, that the difference today is that the tools that the UN used to have to absorb these crises are gone. They're depleted. The different cushions that were supposed to cover for late payments by contributions of member states or non-payments, these are completely depleted. And so they can no longer really work as they're supposed to. And so that exposes the organization to risks of not being able to implement its mandates, as again, Danielle was describing. But so if the financial crisis is not the heart of the problem, what is it then? And I think it's important to really come to this diagnosis to really be able to identify what kind of solutions we can design forward. And in my opinion, what we're seeing today is essentially a divide between the expectations of member states, how they have essentially steadily expanded what they expect the United Nations to do, to deliver, mm-hmm. While at the same time becoming less willing essentially to provide either the political consensus or the financial support that the organization would need to implement it. So it's essentially a gap between expectations and commitments.
Some would argue, however, the issue isn't just about money. This is a point that Mr. Forti and Mr. Kamelli have both touched on. Critics have accused the UN of incompetence. They've pointed to the broader decline of multilateralism itself. They've pointed to the UN peacekeepers failing to prevent atrocities, an inefficient bureaucracy, and a Security Council that protects its permanent members from accountability. Mr. Kamelli, what's your take on these criticisms?
I very much hear that kind of argument, and I think it's important not to dismiss it because the underlying reality is important to address. Yes, there's a perception that the UN is slow, but that's also you have to remember what it is really, and that's because it actually takes time for member states to come to an agreement by consensus. It's a process by member states. Also, there's a perception that the UN is inefficient, and true, it has not eradicated poverty. It does not prevent wars, and at times, even as you were pointing out, the Security Council is blocked. But then, if I may ask that question, is it a fair assessment? And how do you actually make it a fair assessment? I would actually draw kind of a distinction here. There's the failure of political governance within the UN and also the failure of administration of the UN. And so if you're looking at the UN processes by member states, that's political governance. If you're looking into how the organization is run, that would be the administration. And these are two very different things. So the UN is kind of a unique animal. It is tasked with almost impossible missions, certainly none that any private corporation would undertake, and actually admittedly that many member states would not be able to actually endeavor. Most times the UN is sort of a last resort in inextricable circumstances. And so it doesn't really compare to anything we know. And so making an assessment of what it does is difficult. On top of it, as I was mentioning earlier, the UN has more and more mandates that keep on piling up, expectations keep on piling up. But the Secretariat itself doesn't write those mandates. It's the member states. The member states decide what the UN needs to do, but it doesn't deploy the same kind of resources that the UN needs to actually implement them. So who's responsible in this case? Is it the UN for not being able to fulfill the expectations of the member states, or the member states for not giving the UN the resources it needs to actually fulfill those expectations? And paradoxically, member states are increasing those expectations but reducing their support. And so the UN, and I'll finish on this point, at the UN, there's sort of a divide between the kind of authority and responsibility. In most organizations, these go together. At the UN, there's full responsibility, but not full authority because that belongs to the member states.
So it sounds like some of the criticism is valid, but the tasks given to the United Nations is difficult, if not impossible, and the member states increasing their expectations of this organization while trying to reduce their contributions has snowballed this inner and deeper problem. Now let's talk about ways to stabilize the UN without rewarding non-payment. We explained earlier that the two states owing the most right now are the United States at roughly $2 billion with a B and China at around $429 million. The U.S. reportedly paid forward $159 million in May, but still has a long way to go. The U.S. isn't paying largely because of the Trump administration's stance on the U.N. and other international organizations. To be sure, however, the U.S. has been historically the top contributor to the organization. It has also, of course, reaped the benefits of having the U.N. headquartered on its soil in New York. China has seen its contributions rise steeply in the last two decades as its economy and geopolitical clout has grown. China's contributions in 2025 were more than $685 million, just below the U.S.'s $826 million-plus dollar contribution. But how does the U.N. Bring the U.S. and China back to full timely payment? Or should the United Nations plan around the assumptions that they won't?
Maybe on this particular point, it's worth being precise about around those numbers. And I guess the first point is to remind everyone that that the UN budget in itself actually comprises two very different envelopes. There's what is called assessed contributions and then voluntary contributions. The assessed contributions essentially fund the functioning of the organization. And that's about a third of the funding. This one is borne by all the member states according to a formula. And in this formula, as you were pointing out, China and the U.S. account for about 42%, 22% for the U.S. and 20% for China. But that's the smaller part of the funding of the U.N. The bigger part is voluntary funding. And this has no scale of assessment. This is no determined level in which member states need to contribute. And then they can decide out of the blue to stop contributing voluntary contributions. What we're seeing today is a combination of not paying or paying very late the assessed contributions by the US and China, and at the same time, a steep reduction in voluntary funding. And that combination, that scissor effect, if you will, it is very damaging for the ability of the organization to conduct its mandates. Now, more specifically on your question, so if we're specifically addressing assessed contributions, the ones that are mandatory, then you also need to distinguish the specific configuration for the USA and that for China, because they're very different and they also call for different solutions or ways to address them. What's happening for the US is that, as Mr. Forti was explaining, they essentially stopped paying their contribution. And they're explicitly tying the release of their arrears, what they owe to the organization, in exchange for internal governance changes, reforms, cuts in staffing, re-centralization on certain activities rather than others. So they're essentially using their contributions as a lever to force changes within the organization. But there's a limit to that possibility. And there's an article within the Charter of the UN, Article 19, that says if a member state doesn't pay its contribution for 2 years, then it no longer has a vote in the General Assembly proceedings. And the US is actually very much on the border for this particular one. My guess is that their latest payment is just what they need to not have the voting rights lost for 2027. But most likely, if the trend continues, the USA will lose its vote in the General Assembly in 2028. And the magnitude of what they would need to pay to actually maintain that is unprecedented. They would need to pay a full year of contribution, and they haven't done so since the 80s. The case for China is actually very different. China pays its contribution every year, but within each year, it pays it very late, to the point that sometimes it's so late that the secretariat finds itself almost unable to spend the money. And there's a rule in the financial regulations and rules of the UN that forces the organization to give back the money it hasn't spent. So that rule actually, as a matter of fact, has just been changed today. That's almost breaking news. But the two cases, China and the US, are very different and they need to be approached differently. If I take a step back, however, the most important for the organization would probably to acknowledge that the difficulty of having two member states with so much impact and control over the ability of the organization to spend is not sustainable.
It sounds like China has been gaming the system while the U.S. has been playing politics with its money. But beyond the United States and China, what role can other member states, like South Korea, for example, or regional blocs, perhaps the EU, ASEAN, and Southeast Asia, what can these smaller players play in stabilizing the UN budget?
So in the current context, within the current rules, it's obvious that South Korea and other middle powers cannot replace the US or China. Even coalitions of middle powers or mid-sized economies wouldn't be able to actually gather together the same magnitude of the budget that these two represent. The current split of that budget no longer works. And the agreement that was essentially created back in the year 2000 needs to be revisited. And you cannot have two member states that essentially account for half of the regular budget and half of the funding of the peacekeeping operations. But on the other hand of the spectrum, you also cannot have 168 member states that actually pay less together than 5% of the peacekeeping budgets. So the formula of 25 years ago no longer holds. And it's time to probably rethink how you split the pie. And that means for many countries, but hopefully for those middle-sized countries and middle powers who really care for multilateralism, to actually step up to that responsibility and agree to pay more into the UN, and not so much as an expenditure, but really as an investment in international security, because there should be a realization that actually the middle powers are the one who benefit from this organization, and need to actually be more active and take more of an active role in this direction. I would say this is more a question of resilience of the organization rather than fairness about who contributes what and what is really each member state's capacity to pay. So broadening the base is really a sort of form of insurance for everyone. Beyond that, beyond how you split the pie, I think there's a need to look at the budget a little differently. Yes, there's the temptation to consider a budget as just an accounting table, some pluses there, some minuses there. And especially in the case of the UN, that doesn't work. A budget is the most concrete and political manifestation of your political priorities. And middle powers need to understand that, and they need to defend their vision of priorities for the organization, so that the organization is then able to implement them. So beyond the formula, beyond the technical revisions, beyond the budget rules, what is important is really for those middle powers to step up and say what role they actually expect the UN to fulfill, that what role they want to assign to the organization. And that's particularly important today, as the UN is about to appoint its next Secretary General, which will come into office on January 1st, 2027. If I may, maybe point three directions for that particular question. I would say the first question to address is, what is the UN actually for? And by the budget, you can very much have a first orientation for that particular question. The second question, once you have decided what it is for, you also need to be clear about what genuinely belongs inside the organizations and what doesn't. There are, as you pointed out earlier, there are some activities that maybe have accumulated that are not necessarily where the UN is best suited. And maybe other actors and regional partners would be better suited to implement those mandates. This is a tough conversation, but this is one that middle powers could actually push forward because they're present both at multilateral level, but also in those regional forums in which these discussions can happen. And the third question, which is also sort of a pledge or commitment by those middle powers, once you have decided what the UN is for and what belongs in the organizations versus what doesn't belong or could be pushed elsewhere, then those middle powers can very much commit to giving the organization the resources that these activities need and these core functions need to actually perform. So too often, that kind of debate is actually reduced to a single question or a single answer. Spend less, prove that you're more efficient. But spending less really isn't the kind of reform that the UN would need, and certainly not one that the middle powers would be best suited to push. Across-the-board cuts are never really a substitute for reform. Ultimately, what you want is really to push for reforms that actually mean identifying what the UN is uniquely positioned to do.
That was Thibault Kemeli at the New York University's Center on International Cooperation. Thank you for your time, Mr. Kemeli.
Thank you very much for having me.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 173.07 points, or 2.04%, on Wednesday to close at 8,303.41. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ gained 13.17 points, or 1.44%, to close at 929.35. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Andrew.
So, what's our first story today?
Fans were gathered at Incheon International Airport on Wednesday early in the morning to welcome and provide support to national football team captain Son Heung-min and his fellow Taeguk Warriors, who returned after a disappointing World Cup run. And what you're hearing are sounds from the arrival hall as the players walked out the gate.
It was in the early hours of the morning, but what appeared to be hundreds of supportive fans made time to welcome the players. What was it like at the airport?
Well, it takes a real fan to show such devotion as the players' flight was scheduled to arrive at around 4 a.m. Some fans began gathering at the airport 2 hours earlier to set up and get ready to give a warm welcome. By the time the flight arrived, quite a number of people crowded the arrival hall. Alongside Son of Los Angeles FC, other players included Lee Jae-sung of Mainz and Kim Sung-gyu of FC Tokyo and many others who are active in the local K-League. Fans shouted encouraging words like keep your head up and praise the players for their efforts.
This seems to be obviously a big contrast to the welcoming crowd, if we can call it that, which had gathered to greet head coach Hong Myung-bo when he arrived on the previous day. Is that a correct view?
Yes, the difference is night and day, huge stark contrast. On Tuesday, about 300 fans jeered Hong, who is mainly seen as responsible for questionable substitutions and tactics, which resulted in Korea failing to make the round of 32 and finishing number 34 overall, its lowest ever finish at a World Cup. It was unfortunate that Lee Kang-in and other players happened to be arriving in the same flight with Hong, being caught in the crossfire of criticisms only targeted at the coach.
Obviously, the most famous player that came home today was Son Heung-min. Did we get to hear from him at the airport?
Yes, when asked by reporters if he had a message to his fans, Son simply replied, "I'm sorry." As Son and the players headed straight to the exit without making further comments, there were reports that one of the reasons why Son transferred to the U.S. Pro Football League, the MLS, was to be better prepared for the World Cup held in the region, reflecting his dedication to play his heart out for the national team one last time. Many fans were upset at how Captain Son was not fully utilized, being substituted in the second half in all three World Cup games.
While football fans were frustrated, baseball fans were having fun. Dan, you were going to tell us a development in pro baseball here in Korea.
Yes, some assumed pro baseball turnout here in South Korea would be somewhat impacted during the Taeguk Warriors World Cup run, but the figures are out and it shows it will take a little more to pull devoted baseball fans from their seats.
I am one of them, and I guess the poor performance of the men's national team was a factor at the World Cup. But tell us more, Dan.
The Korea Baseball Organization said Tuesday that the total attendance for the season surpassed 7 million already. The league reached the figure in 388 games, easily beating last year's record of reaching it in 405 games.
So I've been a fan of the KBO for most of my almost four decades on this planet. And I think it was, 2 years ago when it started getting real difficult to buy tickets. So I'm not surprised at this new record, but I guess the KBO's popularity is only rising. Is the league on pace for a new record in attendance?
Of course. Last year, the KBO set a single season record with over 12.3 million fans. And at this pace, the league is set to cruise towards exceeding that figure this season. Not only that, the league has cleared every million milestone in record-breaking pace so far.
And what about for individual teams? Has any team seen their attendance go down?
Well, 9 out of 10 teams saw average attendance go up. One team, the Lotte Giants, have seen a slight dip. But even with that decline, the Giants remain one of the top four teams in terms of fan turnout. They remain at over 20,000. With 218 sellouts already, it's only a matter of time for the KBO. The single season record of 331 set last year is shattered soon.
I know the fans in Busan have been long suffering, so my sympathies to the people of Busan. But now to our final story. Dan, what do you have?
For the first time in half a decade, local postage rate in South Korea is raised.
And how big is this hike?
Well, according to the postal authorities, it announced Wednesday that standard domestic postage for a 25-gram standard size item, which would normally be a letter, will increase by 71 from 431 to 501, which is about less than $1 or around 32 cents starting Monday. There will be around a 71 increase for each weight tier.
So we're talking about the old-fashioned way of sending mails, which I actually did last week. So I guess I saved a few nickels and dimes. But why the price hike?
The agency explained that the rate adjustment was deemed necessary due to widening losses caused by declining mail volume and rising costs. Losses expanded from 165.9 billion won in 2024 to 311.6 billion won in 2025.
And obviously, there's been a steep decline in physically mailed letters and papers. Is that correct?
Yes. As digital transformation accelerates, the use of snail mail, such as letters, continue to decrease. This comes while the cost of maintaining the nationwide post office network and delivery and transport networks, continues to rise. The agency also explained that the rise has been set at a minimum level after taking into consideration ways to not adversely burden households. Even with the slight hike, Korea's domestic postal rate remain low compared with other major OECD member countries.
I'm thinking some people might miss writing and sending and receiving physical letters the old-fashioned way, but the decline sounds very real. And that's it for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's time now for the Korea Book Club, our weekly segment where we dive into the world of Korean literature and books, exploring works either in Korean or English translations. Joining us this week, we welcome back our book critic, Fei Liang. Fei, hello, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me back again.
So, Fei, what is your book this week?
This week, I've brought a book that is a household name in Korea. When I told my Korean friends that I was reviewing this book, they all went, ooh, and told these stories about either reading it as a kid or having friends who had read it when they were kids. So, the English translation of this book has just been released this year, but the original Korean book dates all the way back to 2002. That was when it was first serialized online, and it was first published in print a year later. I think that if I say the Korean name of the book right now, many of our listeners will instantly recognize it. The series is called 눈물을 마시는 새 by Lee Young-do, and the English title, with a translation by Anton Herr, is The Bird That Drinks Tears. And today, the book I'm reviewing is the first one in this series. It's called The Heart of the Naga in English.
So I was a member of the Harry Potter generation, but the book's title does ring a few bells, and it does have this C.S. Lewis slash Narnia feel to it. And of course, I've heard that it's certainly a famous fantasy series here in Korea. But they're even making a game based on this story.
Oh, yeah, I heard that they are, and think it's going to be a PC and console game, and it's set to come out next year.
Well, I guess for our listeners who like to game, this book would be mandatory reading. Now, I'm dying to know, what is this book about? And I've heard of movie adaptations and TV show adaptations, but it's not every day that books get turned into a full-on game.
Right, that's true. When they make a whole game out of a book, you know that it's something big scale. The Bird That Drinks Tears is an epic high fantasy series that revolutionized the Korean fantasy genre. That's because it did one thing that nobody did before. It applied purely Korean mythical elements to a large-scale high fantasy story. Prior to this, high fantasy had predominantly been the realm of Western folklore and mythology. You have your elves and your dwarves, you know, your witches and wizards, that sort of thing. The Lord of the Rings would be a good example, and so would Harry Potter, C.S. Lewis. Speaking of the Lord of the Rings, by the way, I've heard Lee Young-do, the author of The Bird That Drinks Tears, get called Korea's J.R.R. Tolkien a lot. And now that I've read his writing, I have to admit, I do see the parallels.
So getting compared to J.R.R. Tolkien, I imagine, must be flattering. So in what ways are the two people similar? And what makes people read The Bird That Drinks Tears and think of Tolkien?
Well, for starters, both series share the fact that they have a really broad world on a scale that requires an actual map to keep track of. The Heart of the Naga comes with a hand-drawn map on the very first page. And second of all, just like in Tolkien's fantasy worlds, in the world that Lee Young-do built, there are multiple races that coexist together. They each have their lands, their specific customs, their histories, and even separate religions. But that is where I think the similarities end. Whereas for Tolkien, elves and dwarves, etc. share the world, in The Heart of the Naga, there are instead four main races based on Korean folklore.
So that's what you meant earlier when you were talking about this book being high fantasy with Korean elements. So what are these creatures inhabiting this world in the bird that drinks tears?
Right. Of the four main races that I just mentioned, the most commonly known one would probably be the Tokkebi. They're these goblin-like creatures who control fire and are very commonly seen in Korean folklore. And after the Tokkebi in the book, we have the titular Naga. The Naga are a reptilian humanoid race that lives in the deepest, darkest parts of the forest. We also have the Rekon, who are these giant anthropomorphic bird people. Mm. And then last but not least, of course, we have good old regular human beings.
So to recap, aside from humans, we have reptile people, bird people, Tokkebi, goblins, a varied mix. We haven't even gotten to the actual story yet, so tell us more.
Right. The cast of characters is definitely something in this book. So moving on to the plot. The plot goes like this. One day, for reasons hidden even to the protagonists, a human, a Rekon, and a Tokkebi are banded together and tasked with a rescue mission. Their goal is to extract a Naga from the heart of Naga territory, which, as I mentioned before, is in the deepest part of the forest. Of course, any good hero quest story like this one wouldn't be complete without its challenges. So the problem our heroes face is this. Not only is the forest full of danger, the Naga are also not really keen on letting one of their own go. Plus, to say that they aren't a friendly race would be the understatement of the century. The Naga are known to be really strong fighters, and to top it all off, they're nearly impossible to kill.
The understatement of the century. Mm-hmm. A strong statement there from Faye. but that must be why the other races need to team up to go on this mission. But hold on, they're reptile people. So yeah. What makes the Naga so strong?
Well, one deciding factor is, and this is very unique, they don't actually have hearts. Now, remember that the title of the book is called The Heart of the Naga. Well, this may be partially related to, and I apologize if you've just had dinner, the fact that when Nagas come of age, they have this ritual where their hearts get taken out and then stored in this great big tower right in the middle of their city. And once a Nagas had their heart taken out in this ritual, they become practically impossible to kill. They have superhuman healing abilities and can regenerate any body part, literally. Even their heads.
So if you chop their head off, it grows right back.
That's right. Well, according to the book, it would take some time, like we're talking a year at least. But yes, eventually the head would grow right back onto their neck.
So that is very fascinating. Would you say then that this book is a little gruesome overall?
Well, yeah, there definitely are some gory scenes just because there's a lot of fighting and a lot of action going on. But since it's a fantasy book, I had pretty much expected that going into the story, so I was okay with it all. But fair word of warning to anyone who doesn't like that kind of writing. Mm. And actually, speaking of the writing, there was something else that I definitely had not been expecting before I started the book, and it turned out to be a really pleasant surprise.
And what is this pleasant surprise that you speak of?
Well, I had gone into the book expecting this really serious, high-complexity fantasy story, right? So I was really surprised when I found myself laughing out loud to some of the author's dry humor. The characters would sometimes be, you know, in the middle of some really high-tension fighting scene. And then somebody, usually the Rekon, the bird person, whose name is Tina Han, would drop something absolutely hilarious, and that would crack me up every single time.
I imagine it's not easy weaving in good humor into a book, especially in this genre.
But, for sure.
You know, it sounds like this book has all the ingredients for a really engaging story.
That it most definitely does. You can add to that an element of mystery, too. Because The Heart of the Naga is the first book in a long series, there are so many unsolved mysteries. We don't know why the protagonists were brought together, we don't know why they must rescue this Naga person, and we don't even know who or what is the great evil force behind everything. Even by the end of the book, all of this is so hidden that you feel like you've just skimmed the very top of something much, much bigger. The book leaves readers on a hard cliffhanger, and I'm hoping that more will become clear in the next installment.
Well, you have me convinced. I can't wait to read The Heart of the Naga, and I hope the rest of the series follows in translation soon. That was Fei Liang, introducing The Bird That Drinks Tears. Thank you, Fei.
Thank you very much.
And that's where we wrap up our show for today. Again, you can always listen to Korea 24 on various apps, KBS Kong, KBS World Radio, and KBS World Radio On Air at 7:10 p.m. Korea Standard Time every weekday. We'll be back tomorrow. I've been your host, Andrew Jung. As always, thank you for listening. Goodbye.